Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a moment from the Movie Geeks United Archive.
Actor Brian Thompson portrays the lead villain in Cobra, a sinister, bloodthirsty character known only as the Night Slasher. Thompson was a relatively new face in the film industry when the Cobra opportunity came around, having made his big screen debut in a brief scene opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator just 2 years previously. Cobra presented him with a sizable role in a high-profile, big-studio action film opposite one of the biggest stars on the planet. What could go wrong?
I was, you know, Sly. You like to be called Sly, and the director said, you know, I don't really understand what, you know, my character's doing. He was called Abaddon during filming in the script. I said, I'm not quite sure what these people are doing. And Sly said, well, you know, basically these people are doing what Hitler did, because they're trying to get the money. And I said, well, okay, but, you know, Hitler had a systematic way to retrieve money from the people that he was exploiting. And, you know, we're kind of going after this car and killing this girl, and it seems indiscriminate.
Mm-hmm.
And that we don't have, you know, that she's like a random target. So I'm not sure how that ties into what Hitler was doing. And I said, well, maybe if we got some Polaroids, you know, that showing that she was targeted, or we're getting their bank accounts, or I don't know, something. And he said, yeah, George, get him some Polaroids. I think that I have verbatim recounted the character conversation that I had. That was it.
So there wasn't a lot there for you to work with, obviously. So tell me your.
No, it was extremely disappointing. Like, one of the things you do for other actors is you stand there off camera. You know, when it's your turn to act, you act off camera, so the person on camera has something to act to. And when I did the big climactic monologues at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. I did it with a script girl. And I said, hey, where's Sly? Isn't he gonna be here? Brian, the basketball game's on.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. No, seriously, yeah, basketball game's on. Oh, I didn't know that. They didn't tell us in acting school that you don't get an acting partner when the basketball game is on.
United, tonight we'll be discussing movies that might actually warrant a sequel. That's going to be an interesting topic and a provocative one, I'm sure. That first clip that you heard was from our archives. That was Brian Thompson. He's an actor and the villain in one of my favorite movies, Cobra. call me crazy. But really interesting, very honest portrayal of what it's like to work with Sylvester Stallone that he provided there. Jerry, how are you, man?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good. Let's bring on Dean. Hey, Dean.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, bud. All right. So we're going to get to... First of all, how many did you guys... When you made a list, how many did you compile titles?
I just took notes.
I didn't really do a list or anything. I just took notes over the last couple of weeks, you know, jotted down stuff here and there. But I didn't make, like, a like set list or anything.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I made a set list of about, you know, I don't know, 15 titles or so.
Oh, wow.
Wow,
but,
I couldn't think of 15.
And all the ones I came up with don't warrant it, so... Well, the thing is, I mean, what do you mean by that? I mean,
I was talking with someone last night about, actually someone who's going to probably call in later tonight, and it's just like some of them that you think about, and you really, because I only did it as to the director and the actors are alive still. Obviously, I'm not going to pick the Magnificent Ambersons or something like that, or... I'm not going to pick Black Narcissus, okay? I mean, you know, I'm not going to do that.
Boy, people would line up for that, wouldn't they? I mean,
everything I picked, the only thing that, in the traditional sense, the only thing that warrants a sequel is money.
From a studio's point of view. You know what, though? I mean, there are movies that, look, I mean, there are classic movies that you don't want them touched. But at the same time, you could imagine the continuing story of
being
fascinating.
Yeah, that's what I went with, really. But
so it's not
none
a question
of them are
of
what you only one, and it's one that I'm actually now dead set against. But I, on one condition, I think it warrants a sequel. But
so in terms of need, I mean, nobody needs anything. I mean, a sequel to anything isn't going to save your life. But it might be of interest to see the story continue. So that was the criteria I used. I have seven. That's the best criteria. I could not think of more than just seven. But I'm sure that this will ignite some discussion, you guys' choices. And
I'm hoping that you picked one of your favorites, because one of your favorites has actually a long storyline after it. So I'm hoping that you picked it.
I know what you're talking about. Maybe we'll bring that up.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to review some... Let me tell you what happened to me, first of all, completely unrelated to movies.
Mm-hmm.
I do my laundry at the laundromat, because my dryer is on the fritz.
I hear you, brother. I hear you about that.
So when I got home from work, I took a nap, as I always do, because I'm like, you know, 90 years old. And then I got up, and I went and I washed them, and then I put them in the dryer, and then I came back home. But something happened, and I was running late anyway, so I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to start the show on time. I pulled up. There was a guy that walked towards the entrance of the laundromat holding a plastic bag, and he stood there at the entrance as I pulled up. And I felt this really, like, nervous energy from him, a weird energy.
Oh, shit.
There was a woman in the laundromat with a bicycle, and, like, I turned the corner, and apparently the dude stole the bicycle. So I had to stick around and with the cops when they came, give a description and all that kind of stuff. But all the while, I felt so terrible for this woman that I was thinking, God, I'm going to miss the show.
Your own show.
Yeah, my own show, and I'm not going to be there. Yeah, but, yeah, it was terribly sad, but... Anyway, that's where I just came from.
I can't beat that. I got nothing.
Yeah.
I just sat and watched Charlie Barrett. That's about it.
All those.
Have you ever seen that movie, Charlie
Barrett?
That's
a great movie. I love that movie.
It's so good. I
want to talk about just a couple of things that are movie related before we get into our lists. I guess the big news is that Nora Ephron passed yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Somebody that I completely would not have expected Nora Ephron to pass away. And it sounds like a completely stupid thing to say. But first of all, I didn't know she was 71.
I had no idea. I didn't realize she was that. I had no idea about that. And that's still too young, but I did not realize that she had leukemia. And supposedly there are clues in her last book that she gave. And I was reading today, and in her last book of essays, she gave this thing, a list of things I will miss and things I won't miss.
Yeah.
So that was, I thought, revealing.
Generally, I had a very warm feeling about her movies.
Mm-hmm. For the most part, I really loved Harper, and if you want to know the God's honest truth.
And she co-wrote
Silkwood.
Silkwood.
Yeah, Silkwood is another one. A lot of great stuff. Diverse.
River Pfister, who also, I think, passed of cancer, I think.
Well,
I think ran in their family. But, I mean, that's one of my favorites of her.
I mean, obviously, When Harry Met Sally, which she wrote, I mean, that gained such recognition and fame and prominence for her.
Right.
She became kind of the female voice in the romantic comedy realm in terms of writer-director, and which she later picked up with Sleepless in Seattle, which Sleepless in Seattle is actually a movie I have a lot of warm feelings about. I haven't watched it in over a decade. But if there was one complaint, this is an interesting topic, and it's probably too involved to go much into right now, but if there's one complaint, and we voiced it over the past years about Nora Ephron movies, it's that I cannot recall a single person of color in any of her films.
Yeah, well, that's kind of true. I mean, she kind of, you know, takes another note from Woody Allen in that respect. You know, like,
well, that's true. That's true as well.
Yeah,
you
mean,
know?
That's also true with the other, her, what's she, oh God, what's the woman's name who made The Holiday and What Women Want? What's her
Shire.
Name?
Shire, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's all. She's also guilty of that. If you want to,
you know, I love the Holiday. I actually
it's grown on me over the years. It's definitely, the more I think about it, I do like that film.
Is that a complaint? Is that a complaint? I mean, would it feel kind of you know, because you're gonna force her to write someone of color just for the sake of having someone of color in the movie? I mean, is
write
that valid?
No, I mean, write what you're familiar with. I mean, it would seem, see, this is something where, you know, George Lucas got slammed for this with the first Star Wars movie. You know, there's not a single black person.
But
know.
Yoda was green.
Well, I thank you. I realize that.
But he didn't come
into
Empire.
This is not just something that Nora was accused of. It's a common thing. I don't know where you go with it. I don't know.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I don't know where I'd go with that argument.
No, I don't know where you go with any. I mean, what do you say? I mean, you write, I guess, from your experience and everything, but there comes a point where if it's political correctness for the sake of political correctness, then it feels forced. It feels phoned in almost, phony.
I think the stuff that defines her work, though, for me personally, mm-hmm. her movies, more than anything, were kind of an example of how extremely charming stars can carry a movie.
Right.
I mean, even a movie that isn't 100% successful, like whatever the last one, the Meryl Streep, Alec Baldwin, Steve Martin one. What was that called?
It's Complicated?
It's Complicated, yeah. I mean,
is that her or is that Nancy Myers?
Always Nancy Myers?
Yeah.
Oh,
I think that's
the
Nancy Myers.
Strike that.
But Nancy Myers owes a lot to Nora.
I think so, too.
Yeah, I do too.
I can't believe
I
made that mistake.
I like Julia though. I thought that was good. I thought that was very good actually.
And a very brilliant Meryl Streep.
I like those Meryl Streep parts of Julia, but I don't particularly care for the Amy Adams.
But I thought the Amy Adams thing was fine too. I know a lot of people like to rag on that part, but I thought that might actually be my favorite Nora Ephron movie in the later years that she made.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, they started shooting Carrie today.
Oh, okay.
Wow, okay.
Chloe Moretz as Carrie White, Julianne Moore as her crazy mother, and Judy Greer is in it too. I guess she plays the principal, the coach.
That's inspired casting.
Yeah, I like her too.
Yeah,
she was one of my favorite things in
The Descendants.
Part of The Descendants her. I like her a lot.
I'm sorry, Cassie. Yeah, that'll be good. I like Chloe Moretz. So I'm excited about that. Scorsese's going to start shooting his next movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, in August. And he has announced that it won't shoot in 3D. Actually, he didn't announce this. Thelma Schoonmaker did. It won't shoot in 3D. Like, I thought that he was going to shoot everything in 3D from now on. But it won't be shot on film either. he's given up on film. He's thrown up his hands and saying, "I surrender."
I'm kind of surprised that didn't happen already. I would have figured that. It's hard to keep track.
I'm sorry about
like
that, guys.
Shooting on film. You know.
Where are you standing, Dean? Are you in a hall or something now?
Yeah, I'm in a hall at the moment.
No, I'm sorry that someone picked up the our line. I'm sorry about that.
Well, that's all right. I didn't hear anything. But,
okay. Well. Okay.
You know what really always irked me, because we had Thelma Schoonmaker, his editor, on, and she actually, at the end of the interview, she told me that actually we're shooting our next movie in New York. And then I said, "Really?" And she said, "Oh, don't tell anybody. I'm not supposed to let anybody know that." And this was months before it was announced that Wolf of Wall Street would be his next one. So
uh-huh.
I was sitting on this news about what Scorsese's next movie would be, and I couldn't say anything. I mean, I guess I could have been like a lot of other people and spilled it, but that just sucks.
Well, it's good that you didn't say anything.
Yeah,
you're trustworthy. But I know it must have been.
I don't
tortured.
Know about that. All right, I guess that's it for major news. We can get to other stuff on Sunday night. Sunday night we have actually.
Well, we have the big one.
Yeah, William Friedkin. So discussion will be limited. So I guess we'll play the hour-long interview and then tail off at the end of it with a little bit of discussion. But, I mean, it is probably, for me personally, it's probably in the top five conversations that we've had featured on the show.
That's exciting. You said that you didn't really ask that many questions. He kind of went off into...
No. He talked a lot, but
okay.
I mean we had a conversation. I mean it felt more like a conversation than some kind of lecture. I just didn't ask a lot of movies about questions about particular movies necessarily. Was completely unintentional. That's just the way it came out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good though. I'm sure that'll be unique.
Yeah. So it's about time. We're finally able to air this thing.
Right. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we've had to sit
up. Does Killer Joe come out? When does Killer Joe come out, his new movie?
I think the 27th of July, I think, something like that.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
So they said, save your interview till July. So I was like, all right, July 1st. That's when we're doing it. Okay. So let's do our movies that might warrant a sequel show.
Okay.
We each have our little notes or our lists, and we have titles at our fingertips. So, Dean, since this was something that you particularly pushed for, I'll let you go first, and you have the most on your list, I'm sure. So, tell us one.
Well, I'll start off my list by mentioning a movie that came out in the late '90s, part of the indie movement. It's directed by Steve Buscemi, stars Steve Buscemi, and was written by Steve Buscemi as well, and it's called Trees Lounge.
Well, that's a great movie.
It's such a terrific movie. I return to it again and again because I love its plotlessness and aimlessness. I like that quality to a movie every once in a while because I get overloaded with plot sometimes. And sometimes I just like movies. My favorite movies are about people, not plot. So Trees Lounge takes place in Long Island, and it follows the main character who's played by Buscemi. His name is Tommy, and he's an unemployed mechanic who spends most of his time in the bar, the title character of the movie, Trees Lounge. And he basically sees all of his friendships and kinships with old girlfriends and best friends and even just acquaintances, new acquaintances. He sees them all just kind of fall off one after another. They kind of just all just come to a dead end. And he comes to the realization in the length of the movie that he's perhaps drinking too much and has no goals in his life. By the time you get to the end of the movie, you realize that, you know, you realize that he's finally realized this himself, and the movie ends. It's a very funny movie, but it also ends, it has these sort of chilling moments of loneliness, which really underlined by the very final shot of the movie, which I won't go into, but it's that final shot of the movie that makes you realize that he's come to some major realization about where he's going in his life. And I think a sequel would really be interesting. Even, you know, 10 years down the line, to show exactly where he is now. And I would think that by now that character would be going into recovery in some way. And I would like to see that character try and maneuver himself through AA and trying to really figure out, you know, if he can go the rest of his life without drinking, and the tricks that he would play on himself, you know, in order to stop drinking, and then fail and keep failing and keep failing. And then I would, you know, the movie has tons of characters in it. I mean, you know, the cast was huge. Everybody from Chloe Savini, Daniel Baldwin,
Mickey Rourke.
Mickey Rourke would be a great addition to the cast.
He was an Animal Factory. I mean, he works well with Buscemi, so I mean,
he's like a he's a drag queen or something, or a crossdresser or something in it, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And that would he'd be a great new character at the AA meetings or something like that.
He's not doing Expendables too, so I mean, he's not busy. So I mean,
yeah. And I don't know. I just this movie just, you know, screams out to me that there's a lot of untied up
potential
in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I have this book, Making My First Movie or something like that. It's a series of Q&As with different directors on their first movie and the struggle.
Right. Right.
Through.
Yeah. I think
Buscemi
I have that somewhere.
Yeah. Buscemi is one of the interviews. And,
mm-hmm.
It's interesting how he said, look, I knew, I'd worked on a lot of films, but I knew absolutely nothing about making films. And he talked about the struggles of financing and directing and composing a shot and projecting an aura of authority on the set and how he worked with actors and how it was strange that at the same time that he was shooting that movie, right around that same time, he was cast to play the director in, what was it, Living in Oblivion?
Living in Oblivion,
that?
That's right.
Yeah.
Living in Oblivion, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like a odd kind of kismet kind of instance. And it's a movie that interests me. And I think your choice speaks to probably what a lot of our choices
right.
are going to speak to, which is a character that we'd love to see the continuation of their story. I mean, a lot of times it's the character that you can imagine a life taking place beyond the length of that original film.
Yeah,
and so many lesser movies, you know, it's just, it's all packaged, it's all tight and right there, and what you see is all you get. And I love movies that feel like they have a life that exists beyond the frame of the movie.
Right.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you know, a lot of the movies, you know, that, you know, I mean, I was interested in putting a lot of movies on this list, but I also did have to consider, like, you know, I toyed with putting Green Bird on my list, for example, because that's a movie that I like, and I feel the same way about that character. I feel that there's more to that story. But at the same time, there's a certain beauty in Green Bird in that we don't know what happens, you know. So, I don't know. I had to sort of walk a fine line, you know, to try and figure out, okay, well, is it better just to leave it like that, or move on, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know.
Okay. Jerry, what's one of your
Pretty funny that you picked Trees Lounge, because I was thinking about, actually, my favorite Buscemi film, even more so than Trees Lounge, is Lonesome Jim. But it's just so recent, and everyone's so young in the movie still, I would love to see that character like 15, 20 years down the line and see what
mm-hmm.
happens to Casey Affleck character. But that's just something I was thinking about over the years, just Lonesome Jim. But I did pick Green Bird because I do think that I would, not now, obviously, because it's only, what, two or three years old, but if you go 10 years down the line, because it's very interesting. If Noah Baumbach had made that movie 15 years ago, he would have gone with the girls to Australia. He would have gotten on that plane and he would have gone. There's no question about it. Just go back and watch Kicking and Screaming if you need any confirmation on that. He's definitely going to do that. Now, it's very interesting. The Greenberg, how shall we say it, is kind of like, you want to say, the Jesse Eisenberg and Nicole Kidman's child in Margot at the Wedding all growing up.
Yeah.
You really do want to say that. He's the product of monsters, and he has become in his own way a monster. But I'd love to see, I don't think his relationship with Chloe Sevigny is going to, not Chloe, God, you see that slip, Greta Gerwig, everyone does that. But I don't think Greta Gerwig is going to work out. I don't see that happening. I would like to see just how he functions. Does he stay out in Los Angeles? Does he try another go at the band? Or does he go to, the whole thing about becoming a veterinarian, does he really go ahead and do that? Some metamorphosis happen in the course of the film that makes him change his ways, or does he stay the same? And you honestly don't know at the end. You're left with such an open-ended thing. That's the brilliance of the movie. A movie that was, I think, unfairly dismissed because of the common criticism. I went to go see a Ben Stiller movie and it wasn't funny. It's not that kind of film, guys.
That's Noah Baumbach, correct?
That is correct. It is classic Noah Baumbach. It's funny, in an uncomfortable kind of way.
He strikes me as a filmmaker, much like Woody Allen, that whether he gives his characters different settings or what have you, I mean, he's returning to certain themes and exploring them from a different kind of angle through different characters. And that strikes me as he matures, as the kind of character that he would return to say, where are they now, and how does that reflect where I am now and my feeling about things? You know?
Right. I think that would be a Greenberg sequel, someone there down the line. Now, as far as Kicking and Screaming goes, I think they made that sequel. It's called Friends with Kids. I really do believe that. I was just watching it a couple of months ago. Yeah, these are all these guys growing up. Yeah, sure, why not? But no, Greenberg, I do think, I would like to see what happens. And I think, like you said, with a lot of our choices, like with Trees Lines, it would be very interesting. We're not doing this. This has nothing to do about money potential. Obviously, none of these movies made money when they came out. They have a cult following. And it would just be really interesting to see, what he does, what happens to him as we get older, what happens to him as he gets older.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do agree. I toyed with putting it on my list, and I just, I think I just came to a point, really, where I just said, okay, I've got a fine list already. It's okay. but if there was a Greenberg sequel, I would be there, because that was my favorite movie of that year.
I was
like one of the few people that, put it at, at the very top of the year's offering.
Sean on Twitter offered, what the heck is this, offered his pick for a movie that needs a sequel, Dr. Detroit.
That does, obviously, that does need a sequel. Oh, my God.
Or a reboot, at least.
He says, because after the end credits, they said that a sequel was coming. I guess they really thought that movie would be successful, I guess. But
I don't even think
that opens
up
another
wide theatrical release. I don't remember that coming around here. I saw it on.
Yeah, I knew
on VHS,
that. I knew that there was no way I was going to see that movie. I mean, with my aversion to Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, I know. Did he like clog up the toilet?
There's just something. Something so like doughy and annoying about Dan Aykroyd to me.
But he was the best actor on Saturday Night Live, I think, during that period. I thought that he was the best committed actor. He would just.
I wish he was committed.
Just about anything.
All right, guys, we got a lot to do. We got a lot to do. We can't just go on the positive. Who was the best on SNL?
Okay, so what's your first choice?
I had written down this pick. This was one of the first titles that came to mind. And then, Dana, I went on your Facebook page tonight, and I saw a poster for it. And I was like, damn, he's going to think that I stole this. But I didn't. The Candidate, the Robert Redford movie from 72.
You know, that, I just bought that movie, and I went and put it on my list, so I'm really glad you're mentioning it.
And Redford, I mean, this was actually a discussion with Redford as well, where he said, well, that's one character that I would be interested in returning to and exploring.
Yeah, there was talk about that, I mean, for a
while. And Redford is this young, very, very handsome, idealized guy from outside of the political system that decides to run for Senate for California. And he doesn't think he's going to have any chance of winning.
Right.
And through the course of the movie, he gathers momentum, and he's probably more than likely going to be the winner, which he ends up being. But in the course of that, I mean, he kind of has the danger of becoming part of the system that he wanted to be outside
of. He's sort of forced to make he doesn't even really make the compromises. He just finds himself in the middle of the compromises being made all around him by his handlers and everything.
Yeah, and the last line of, you know, we won, and he's, you know, what do we win? That's the last line.
Yeah, what do we do now?
That'd
be interesting. I would welcome that. I would welcome anything like along those lines from him, but yeah, I mean, it'd be great to see.
It would
but
be
also,
fascinating,
I mean,
to see that character, trying to manipulate the political system of today, and possibly actually becoming in some ways the character that he ran against in that movie. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I would think I could, you know, obviously his political career would evolve since back then. So, I mean, he might be at a very high level of government, maybe a presidential campaign or something. And I can see him actually selling his soul in the intervening years and becoming what he despised. And maybe the arc of the next film would be the opposite of the arc of the Candidate, where he gets it back. I mean, he part of the big machine. And finally, he comes to the realization that he wants to speak truth to power.
Right.
Almost like a Bulworth kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
That's an interesting thing that you bring up. You know, because Bulworth, we're never going to get a sequel to that. just on a number of reasons, but Bulworth could be looked upon in that vein, though, of political satire that unfortunately we just don't see anymore as kind of a pseudo as was Bob Roberts too. And we just don't see enough of those films, unfortunately.
There are not enough political movies. It used to be a great subgenre that we had a lot of, and that's disappeared as we've become more apathetic, I think.
It seems like whenever you talk, it just alienates such a large section of the population. When you mention politics, people automatically know. You know, the studio, anybody know.
That's a killer. That's box office death. You know.
I mean, you might, and they have Nicole Kidman in it too. While you're at it, you know, with that box office twist. You know, just there you go. And I love
George
Nicole
Clooney,
Kidman. I'm just like,
George Clooney is probably the only person that's unafraid of making political movies nowadays. He's the only one,
and it's a good thing. And you know, bless him for it. But I mean, he's having a lot of trouble getting people to see them. But you're right; he's unafraid, and good for him.
And you know why? Because you know why he's driven to do that? Because he's inspired by movies that, like The Candidate, movies that come from that era of filmmaking more than anything. And also, I mean, that's the world he kind of comes from with his father and being a journalist and that kind of thing. But in a way, I mean, The Candidate is, and I haven't seen it in so many years, but The Candidate is such a contained movie that the lessons that you can learn from it are all in the movie, and they're just as relevant now as they ever were.
Watching it the other day, I was definitely struck by that feeling that, you know, it really, in a lot of ways, it really hasn't aged at all. I mean, you know, in its ideas and even its portrayals, you know, I mean, it is a movie about a guy that, you know, runs on principle and then gets caught up in the marketing of it all.
So the only reason to make a sequel necessarily would be we need to be reminded of this message. But the message of a sequel would be the exact same as the message you get from the original. So it would almost be like a do-over, like a refresher, no matter what direction you take with the material, I think.
But you know, the great thing about it too would be, you know, the concentration on that character. That's the thing that would be, you know, the difference. You know, but message wise, I think you're right. But focusing in on what happens to that character would be the big, you know, difference in it. You know.
Like so, Dean, what is next on your list?
Well, this one, I think you guys will all agree. I think this is a movie that we all have affection for, and it's 1983's The Big Chill. And you know, you think about The Big Chill, and you think about all those people that were in it, and what an iconic movie was of its time, and for its generation, that is the baby boomer generation. You know, but you think about all those people in it, and every one of them is still around, you know, and still working, still doing a lot of work. And it seems almost natural to think that The Big Chill would be considered for a sequel, because now the baby boomer generation is obviously growing older, and I think it would be fascinating to see what all of those characters, how they were dealing with the major shift in technology and just the major changes in the world that have happened since 1983. And, you know, one idea I had for it, for the sequel, which I don't know exactly what would happen. The characters would have to, you know, take over at that point. But I think the characters are so rich in that movie that, you know, it would be very easy for Kasdan and his wife, to, Meg, to actually come up with, you know, where would they be right now. But one thing I thought of was, wouldn't it be fun to have some sort of, like, I wouldn't want to make it a dream sequence, but maybe some sort of, like, daytime reverie where one of the characters, maybe Kevin Kline or whatever, is just thinking and imagining what life would be like if the Kevin Costner character, who didn't appear in the first movie,
right?
You know, if the Kevin Costner character was still around. And that way you could finally have Costner appear in the movie as the character
that wasn't in
The Big Chill. So I think, you know, I mean, I just think it just seems absolutely natural that The Big Chill be considered as a sequel. But it would be one of those things where it would, you know, I think that the sooner they did it, the better it would be.
Well, first of all, I think you should call it The Bigger Chill. And secondly, it would have to have a lot to do with their children as well. I mean, because when they reach this certain age, I mean, their kids would be young adults starting their own lives. You know, their own lives would be in motion by this point.
Yeah.
So that would be the dynamic, and it strikes me as the kind of material, like I was talking about with Greenberg, that Lawrence Kasdan would return to, at least in spirit. Say, okay, because he's a filmmaker that always says, okay, where am I at this stage of my life? Even his last movie, he was talking to his wife, and he said, you know, there's no movies about people our age, people that still enjoy life, still get a lot out of it, still have sex, still do all this kind of stuff. There's no movies made in our demographic. So I can absolutely see him returning to those themes, as he has, certainly, but maybe that particular story, too.
Yeah. It just seems like a, you know, to mention The Big Chill for me seems like a almost kind of a no brainer in some ways. But we do need reminding of how important that movie was during its time period. Even if you don't think it's a perfect movie or whatever, I certainly don't. But
and instead of Motown songs, we'd have 80s electronica, wall to wall.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah. Jerry, what do you think? The Bigger Chill, what do you think, Jerry?
Well, couldn't you say, though, in all seriousness, that Grand Canyon is sort of the sequel?
Well, no, I don't want to, like, bandy around and you know, I mean, I want to go back to,
you want to go back to those exact characters, okay.
Those all exact right. characters.
But
you
I
know,
think
I mean,
he,
you know,
in some way, he is addressing that, and I think he also does it to an extent in Darling Companion, too, that I think. But no, I understand. You want to go back to those exact same characters. You know, it's a very watershed moment in film. It's a film that hit a lot of people, and I don't see, it's a movie that made a lot of people who didn't grow up in the 60s say they feel like they missed something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an important...
Yeah.
Would William Hurt be dead?
Ooh.
Well, I mean, why? I guess he would, because he's got the, or I don't know, that's a good question.
I mean, maybe that's why they regroup again. I mean, they grouped up the first one for a funeral.
Mm-hmm.
But William Hurt was on
this role.
William Hurt was on such a self-destructive path in that movie.
Right. No, you're right. Okay.
But then again, Goldblum turned into a fly in the intervening years.
Well, that's true. That's true. He did.
He fought dinosaurs, so he has a lot of stories to tell, too.
Wow.
What a life.
True.
Wow.
I ever tell you about the time I fought a dinosaur, a T-Rex?
And Kevin Kline,
wow.
Kevin Kline,
oh my
ate
God.
Goldfish and won an Oscar, so...
Good choice.
That is a very good choice, Dean. They're both very good choices.
I wish I would have chosen that one, though. Jerry, what do you got?
Well, I got the one I've been talking about all along here. So I'm watching a couple weeks ago, Woody Harrelson and Rampart, that movie that just, well, the Orm Moverman movie.
Yeah.
And I like that. That's a good movie. He's actually very good in that. He's very good in everything. And I was thinking, okay, let's just go ahead and do this. So the next day I went and I reread Quentin Tarantino's Natural Born Killer script to see if there was something there in a sequel. Then I broke out the VCR from the basement and put in the director's cut of Natural Born Killers. Well, I don't know if I really want a sequel to this, because the only way I could see a sequel, because I'm not a big Oliver Stone fan. He's not a favorite director of mine. I thought the movie where he says it's a satire, I just think it's, when I was talking about movies from the 90s, some of them don't hold up. This is the one that I was referring to.
I feel the same way about it.
Yeah, I'm watching it and taking a lot of notes. I broke out the script again. There's always been this argument in Killer Instinct, the Jane Hampshire book, and other things, that if Tarantino's script is vastly different, it's true. His emphasis is not really on Mickey and Mallory in the first half. He's really more interested in Robert Downey Jr.'s character, who I forgot was doing a really bad Australian accent. That completely floored me. I'm watching, like, really? Tony Stark? Come on, man.
You know who he's doing, though.
He's doing the guy from Hard Copy, isn't it? It's supposed to be Hard Copy.
Right.
I don't know. The fact that I remembered that, while that was the first thing I thought of while watching it, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, this is Hard Copy.
Which has absolutely no currency today, but, you know. But
I love his funky accent in that, though. I think it's
just
hilarious.
Me on guard. I forgot all about that. But, okay, here's my thing, though. I have to give Tarantino and especially Stone the credit. I think the closing credits is one of the scariest things. Because you let them get away. You let them.
Yeah.
And then Tarantino is guilty of this too. I mean, it's in his script. I mean, he lets them get away. My thing is, okay, now this is what I was originally thinking. What would a sequel be now if they're still, let's say they are alive? What would their lives be? Do they become like that sitcom? Does she basically become like her folks? In that sitcom kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Does he become like them? Is that basically what we're watching? Just it's going to start all over again. They will become like their parents. Or is there something else there? Now, what's interesting about Woody Harrelson's performance is that there is a very, he speaks in that very, even in the film, Tarantino-esque voice that you hear a lot of Brad Pitt from Inglourious Basterds in Mickey Knox. There are some moments you're like, wow, you know, they don't, they could be brothers. They could be cousins or whatever. That also goes for Clarence in True Romance. There's a lot of similarities in their mannerisms and in their dialogue. But then I'm thinking about it, you know, Tarantino was smart to focus on Robert Downey Jr. because the problem with Mickey and Mallory, they're not that interesting. They're really not that interesting. I actually think that the movie owes its very existence not to Badlands, not to Bonnie and Clyde, but to David Lynch's and Barry Gifford's Wild at Heart.
Mm-hmm.
I think they owe everything to Sailor and Lula. Mm-hmm. And they're far more interesting characters. And I'm watching, and I couldn't get Wild at Heart out of my mind. I'm like, wow, this is really does owe so much to that movie
I'm glad you said that. You know, because this brings up first of all, let me ask you a question. The Tarantino script, which I haven't never read,
mm-hmm.
you know, Oliver Stone took it, and it's obvious from his treatment of it that he was determined to make it a message movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine that Tarantino's script was a message movie, necessarily.
No, Tarantino's not interested in message. Tarantino's
right.
interested in something he... You know, it's really interesting. There are, in some weird way, his films do speak of the times in some weird way. But he had no interest whatsoever in making a satire. It's a straight on really exploitation film in his version. And I would like to basically, I'm almost saying, like, if you feel this movie, if this was not what you had in mind, make a sequel with these characters. And maybe show us how you would do it. Not a remake, but a sequel. And that would be the only way I could even stomach watching it. But as I'm reading it and watching it again, though, I'm realizing they're not that interesting. He would really have to populate it with other characters, like he did with his screenplay. And, you know, in the movie, it doesn't really even get interesting until you're at the prison.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be honest. Until Tommy Lee Jones, and you got Tom Sizemore, who just... Oh my God! And
I mean, there's a lot of bold strokes. I mean, the movie is all bold strokes, but
yeah,
and quite a bit of it works for me. It just gets a little tiresome after a while, but
yeah.
And obviously it's prophetic about the state of the media and how it inspires this bloodthirstiness. But at the same time, I don't. Like his portrayal of Mickey and Mallory, because I was, and this was elucidated for me by a Twitter post that Oliver Stone made. He did a Q&A last week on Twitter, where he answered like 10 questions and then he was out of there. but he answered something about Mickey and Mallory, and he made a statement of they're just too pure for this world. I was like, what? And that's the kind of bullshit that you could feel in Natural Born Killers. That's a real turnoff to me.
Yeah.
But characters like Sailor and Lula, you can make the argument that they're pure. Like that's a pure relationship, and the violence and the chaos is the world that surrounds it that they're trying to survive in. Yeah.
That's true. That's the big difference. They're not, you know,
the purveyor.
They're not necessarily the purveyors of the chaos. They're actually trying to fight the chaos.
Innocent about them.
Yes,
there is something very innocent about them. It's just, you know, you're watching. You know, I'm watching this again, and I couldn't get Wild at Heart out of my mind. And I won't lie to you. I would hope one day that maybe they would all, Barry Gifford and Lynch and all of them would come back and make the other book. I mean, there was a sequel made, Perdita Durango with Rosie Perez, that she's a character. I think that's the character. What's her name? What's her, Rosalina?
Isabella,
yeah.
She plays. And then there's kind of a side sequel, if you would, of that, you know, other characters from those stories. But they are such a fascinating characters, you know, and Mickey and Mallory, I don't know, but it was an interesting experiment. I wanted to research it, and, you know, it's like if Tarantino came back, I would entertain it, but I don't see it. I hope it never happens.
Yeah.
But it was just something I had to get out of my system.
I thought that you were going to get into the fact that, you know, it might be a more interesting sequel if the main character now were Robert Downey Jr.'s character and Mickey and Mallory were secondary characters.
Right.
You know,
he
really.
And he can't be. He's dead.
That's the problem.
That is the big problem. You're a most interesting character.
Mickey missed when he shot him. When he shot him at the end.
Yeah, he missed.
Yeah. 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 He lived. He just lived through it. It's fine.
I'm Iron Man.
And now Robert Downey Jr. is on Fox News, and that's great. That's actually very, that's an intriguing concept.
Right.
Jerry, so I appreciate that.
No problem.
Is it my turn, I guess?
Yeah.
My next choice is just on purely pleasurable level, because I find that this film is purely pleasurable. and it was a remake, but they've talked for years about doing a sequel, but unfortunately the director is in prison, and that's the Thomas Crown Affair. Pierce Brosnan, Rene Russo.
Mm-hmm.
I have always adored this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a feeling of just slick coolness in the movie. It's visually it's just shiny, and the chemistry between Brosnan and Russo is extremely special,
right,
in this movie. And you could imagine that their story continues on, and they've written the script for it. It's just a question of making it.
Mm-hmm.
Just a really kind of inventive, fun, exhilarating, romantic, sexy heist movie. I mean, just a really clever movie, Thomas Crown Affair is. So I would welcome a return to that
mm-hmm.
world, actually.
Yeah. It is a great one of the great remakes, I think, and you're right. It brings the chemistry between those guys. You know, would be the reason to make it, I think. You know,
I think so. I would welcome it, definitely.
And a great female character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
when
I think of like memorable female characters from the decade of the '90s, Rene Russo is definitely one of them in that film. It's very distinctive and strong, and it comes across as very specific. I mean, it's not like you're a generic strong woman just because we have to have somebody go up against Pierce Brosnan. I mean, she feels authentic in the movie.
Well, I mean, it was a case of really good casting too, because I mean, she kind of projects that in almost everything
that
I can recall that she did, you know, in that period, you know, even in something like, you know, In the Line of Fire or whatever, it's, you know, she does have that sort of that strength, you know, and it's difficult to, you know, name other actresses that are working today that projects just that quality that Rene Russo has.
While remaining sexy and vulnerable in the right quantity. You know?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. So that's mine. Dean?
I decided to go with something that I'm not sure if... I'm not sure if I'm the only person in the world that loves this movie. It's a superhero movie of sorts, but it just didn't have a great time at the box office, and I'm not sure if there's a cult out there for it, but it's based on a series of comic books, and it's called Mystery Men. It came out in the late 90s, 1999.
Great movie. I love that movie.
And that group of characters in that movie is just ridiculously fun to me. I mean, everybody in it, you know, Ben Stiller, William H. Macy, Janine Garofalo especially. She was my favorite part of the film. And I just don't see, besides the fact that it bombed at the box office, I just, you know...
That was a rough summer, man. That was a rough summer. It came out the same day as the Thomas Crown Affair, if I'm not mistaken, and the Sixth Sense.
Oh, yes. That's right. Sixth Sense. That's what killed it. I'm not quite sure, you know, does that movie have a cult?
It does have a cult following.
I know people that like it.
There are people that like it, and it is a good, I would welcome it. It was a fun movie. I enjoyed it very much. I mean, that came out at a very crowded day, because I also think The Iron Giant, if I'm not mistaken, I remember all this is frightening, but The Iron Giant came out the same day as well. So, I mean, that's a crowd. That's one of those days you're like, really, you're not all going to win today.
Yeah,
By the way, I don't want to get too far off topic. I just want to bring this up because I just saw this posted on Facebook on Cloris Leachman's page.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of sequels, she just signed on for a pivotal role in Raging Bull 2.
Oh, my God.
Does she have the Joe Pesci part?
God, that's terrible. She probably has the Moriarty part.
Wow.
Maybe.
Oh,
thank God, Jamie, thank you for saying that, because I thought you were going to say something really, really tragic. So thank you for
Yeah.
Okay.
So I just wanted to, it's a sequel.
It's
so
related.
I mean, it fits. Yeah.
It's related. But, I mean, with Mystery Men, you know, it just seems a shame that they built this world, you know, and the world, you know, seems extremely complete to me. And the characters all just have such a snippy kind of friendship, you know. You know, the possibilities for more hijinks, you know, are kind of endless. And you know, again, all the actors are still around working, and so you know, I don't know.
I am sure.
It's one of those things that would never happen, but you know.
No, I am sure that they designed that movie to be a franchise.
Yeah.
It just wasn't successful, so it nipped it in the bud.
Right.
But, I mean, that strikes me as something that they planned to return to
mm-hmm.
if it was a success, you know.
And I've got a couple of other movies like that that I think were designed as being franchises, but they never picked up on. And, this is one of those, I think, where it's just like, okay, come on, pick up on it again. You know, maybe it just wasn't. I think people might be ready for it now again. You know, I mean, I think it might fly.
Well, especially since superhero movies we're inundated with them. So maybe it might be nice to have it turned on its head again, somewhat, you know, inverted, you know. Like the normal guy can be a superhero, you know, a guy that just suffers from flatulence can be a superhero.
That could be every man could be a superhero movie.
Yeah, every single man watching a football game on a Sunday can be a superhero. All right.
Okay,
well
we're on a
Ben Stiller kick. Hey, Ben Stiller has two movies so
two
far.
Two movies on here.
Yeah,
two movies.
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. Okay, so Jerry.
Okay, the next three that I have are all like this is the epitome of self-indulgence and selfishness.
You're clumping them all together?
No,
okay.
I'm just saying that the three that I have concrete ones. One of them I talked about on this show, but you know already. But I'll talk about it again later. But obviously, the one I'm going to bring up now is something I actually have thought of a great deal over the years. And I keep changing my mind how it should go. But that would be David Gordon Green's All the Real Girls.
Oh yeah,
want a sequel? I'm not sure. And I don't know that David Gordon Green would come back or even would want to come back. Or I don't know if any of these people, because even Paul Schneider, to an extent, is very popular. But I would like to see a real-time sequel of where they are. It's been, it will be 10 years the film has been out next year. It will be its 10-year anniversary. And I don't know if they could ever get back together. I think there's a better chance of them getting back together, obviously, than Tom and Summer and 500 Days of Summer. That's never going to happen. No, but I mean, that sequel's been done. It's called Like Crazy, if you want to know the honest truth. If you want to know what a sequel to 500 Days of Summer would look like, go see the movie Like Crazy, because that's kind of, I feel like, kind of a continuation in some ways of that. But what is amazing about All the Real Girls is that the Zoe character, Noelle, had so much promise. She went away to school, and she really made something of herself, and she comes back. And there's a really tragic scene of her working in a mill that's probably closed down by now. And she really, you know, sort of flounders. But he, Paul Schneider, on the other hand, he might actually make something of himself because he is talented. He is creative. I would imagine that he would leave and maybe go on, maybe be an actor, a director, a playwright, anything, some sort of performer, something in the arts. And he would come back there. And maybe she would realize, you know, say, you know, maybe want to get back together with him, and they would try it again, and just see where they are in different parts of their lives. But I would think he would be on the upswing, and she would be on the downswing, personally, because when the last time we see her, she's with Danny McBride, as soon as she's decided to be with Bustass, which the look on Paul Schneider's face is, wow. It's let's be honest, he's walking in there, he's never going to look at macaroni and cheese the same way ever again.
So
and he goes and puts his fist through his car window. You know, you're thinking, but, you know, there's still something there, and you're like, hey, maybe they could make something work, but maybe they can't. But I would love to see all those characters. It's very interesting. The actor that plays her brother has become a very big deal lately in Boardwalk Empire and Take Shelter. What's his name? The guy from Boardwalk Empire.
Michael...
Shea Whigham.
That's right.
He's become actually rather
like
popular.
I said, Shea Whigham.
Yeah. Oh my God, if Michael Shannon was her brother, they would have all been killed.
That would be scary.
They'd all be killed.
Was scary enough, you know.
Yeah. But I would of all those movies, because I was thinking Elizabethtown, but no, I like that movie, but there's nothing there. And even Garden State, I was kind of curious, where would they be now? But it's really, I go with all the real girls, because that would be the one
I think you're right about picking that one, too. I think you're absolutely 100% correct that all real girls would be, that would be an amazing game.
But let me ask you guys,
there's so many places you could go with it.
I think there's a lot. Let me ask you guys a question, though, because this is the big question as far as David Gordon Green is concerned. Is he capable of making a movie like this anymore?
I think he could make anything he wants.
I think he's got such a diverse style. I don't think he wanted to make comedies. He wanted to do that for a while.
Yeah.
And I applaud him for doing that. So I definitely think he could come back and do this in a heartbeat.
And, I mean, you know, it's only a matter of time before he returns to, you know, that different sort of filmmaking that's illustrated by All the Real Girls and George Washington and even Snow Angels, and I think that would be a perfect thing for him to do. And I do love those two main characters. I still think that movie is one of the best love stories of the past two decades.
I agree. It's something very natural and very just. It's not. There's nothing artificial about it.
No, it totally seems real. It really feels like it's unfolding right in front of you, and I love that immediacy of it, and I do love all those other little characters. Again, it's another movie with lots of little characters over to the side. But, you know, there could be a lot going on with them as well. You know, like Patricia Clarkson and even Danny McBride and so forth.
He's so big. They'd have to probably he'd want a bigger part in this movie.
Yes.
I have never seen it.
It's a good movie. It's a good little movie, man. It's worth checking out.
You would dig it. I find it. You know, it's very moving. I think, and like I said, it feels utterly, utterly real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a compliment to those two lead actors, most of all, I think, Zooey Deschanel and Paul Schneider, who I still don't think that Paul Schneider is as big as he should be.
But he was on Parks and Recreation for a couple seasons. And
He was, but I mean, where is he now? I mean, he should be in, you know, tons of movies. And
no, he should,
not,
I agree. He's got bit parts in them, unfortunately, but, you know, yeah, I agree. He should be bigger than he is.
Yeah.
Okay, that was your choice, Jerry. So
yeah, that
I just went out of one of mine. Let me look at my meager list here. All right. Well, I'll, before I get into the heavy hitters, let me go with another purely pleasurable pick. And this will get a lot of groans. Because this is my favorite worst movie of all time.
Oh, no. I know what it is.
Yes.
I think we all do. That's why we're excited.
I got to go with Cobra.
Yes!
I mean,
you want to bring Cobra back, huh?
I absolutely want to see the continuing adventures of Marion Cobretti.
Definitely, dude. I'm all for it.
This, I mean, just a, like a cheese fest, this movie, and a project of such enormous ego run amok, as the opening clip at the very top of the show we played illustrates. There's just something so irresistible about this movie for me, and this was another movie that he had every intention of making a franchise out of. It just didn't perform as well
right. As
he expected it to. But this is like Stallone's Dirty Harry. And it's completely cheesy and ridiculous, but you can't replicate. It's one of those things that you can't replicate it. Yeah, I think they can make another Cobra movie fairly easily, and it could be just as bad, but not coming from the same kind of perspective and place he was at his, in his life at that time. Because, I mean, he was like the biggest, you know. He was a huge action star. He was playing grab ass the entire shoot with Brigitte Nielsen, and he wasn't at all like as involved as he should be. And just the choices that they make, the whole cult that joins together in a garage and they clank axes together. That's their whole ritual. I mean, just completely silly, but done very straight. I mean, these people did not know the level of comedy they were producing. It's kind of like one of my favorite albums, actually, The Transformed Man, which is an album that William Shatner made.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Oh, my God.
Like 69
okay.
or something. I would
the
listen
classic
to that
William Shatner album.
Absolutely. I would listen to that all the time, over and over again. What makes that album such a delight is that it is so funny. It is so ridiculous and awful, but Shatner had no idea. Shatner thought he was making great art. I mean, this was like an artist's passion coming through. Now, today, Shatner's in on the joke.
Right.
I mean, he plays up the whole, hey, it's me, like, talking, singing, and doing this kind of thing. You know,
it's
become a whole shtick for him. But then, back then, he was dead serious about that album, and that's why that album is such a pleasure to listen to. And I think the same thing would be true of Cobra if they went back and made another one.
I knew you were going to bring this up, so I think, yeah, I mean, of course. No, I would love
you
to
know,
see
if
who would,
if we were, if,
who else
if
would be
were,
in it?
Who else would be in it?
Yeah.
Oh, who would be his love interest? Or, you know, even the detective. I mean, even his partner. You know, there's always the partner, and they're present in Dirty Harry movies, too. The partner that's a slob, that eats fast food, that eats a... That would be the person that eats the hot dog at the crime scene, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, David McBride. Yeah, that would be funny. You know, if you were going to make this movie, I think what would make it insanely much funnier would be to, even though, you know, Stallone has aged, you know, 30 years or whatever since that has happened, to still make it a movie that was set in the 80s. It doesn't matter that he's aged. It's still in the 80s.
Oh, my God. You know who you get to be in it? Speaking of that, Arnold. Arnold has to be in it. He's not doing anything now. I mean, he could be in it.
Well, there's a touch of that in, like, Expendables 2, and I'm, like, looking at the Expendables 2 trailer, and I'm thinking, oh, God, this is going to be awful. I can't wait to see it.
Oh, I can't. It's got my name all over it. I mean,
And there's that scene of Arnold that he's holding this big gun. He's like, I'm back. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is just too great. But I think, also, that's probably self-aware cheesy.
Oh, that is
and,
total, yeah.
Cobra wasn't, you know, which is what makes it special. And I, in terms of Schwarzenegger, I put Commando as his, you know, cheesy kind of masterpiece of the same ilk. I mean, Schwarzenegger's carrying a tree through a forest at the opening of Commando.
I know, that's right. No, I agree. Someone had suggested that on one of our links last night.
That is
Cobra
so great.
Commando.
Oh, that is so great. I love that movie. I love both of these movies. And they epitomize that whole something that's dying, which is that the 80s action star. I mean, that was a huge period for those guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was their
golden age. I mean, they were basically playing, superheroes without the capes and the costumes. That's all.
Yeah.
They just didn't have the costume, you know. So,
I mean, that's the thing. Arnold and Stallone, they tried. I mean, they actually, I enjoy Cliffhanger a lot.
Right.
That's in the 90s, but... You know, by the mid-90s, I mean, Eraser is okay, but, you know, the magic had just worn off, and I think people, you know, unfortunately got tired, you know, of it, unfortunately. But they were fun. That was their golden age, the 80s. There's no doubt about that. Those movies, you turn them on late at night or whatever, they are a lot of fun to watch.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Never get bored.
Oh, yeah.
Never get bored.
Never. Yeah, never. Jeff O'Brien on Facebook says, the Christopher Lambert movie Gunman... and Solo with Mario Van Peebles. I'm a sucker for movies shot in and around Puerto Vallarta.
I remember. You know what the sad thing is? I think I paid money to see Gunman with a friend of mine. We went to that afternoon matinee of that. I rented and fell asleep during, though. But
well, maybe if they make a sequel, everyone will get in for free as an apology or something. All right, so that's my next pick. Dean, what's yours?
I'm going to go with a film that was obviously designed to have a sequel, but for some reason or another, and I don't really know the reasons behind this. Maybe you guys can illuminate this for me. But why in the hell did they not go ahead and make a sequel to Unbreakable? Because mm-hmm.
they were supposed to be a trilogy. I mean.
Yeah, so why hasn't that happened yet? I mean, to me, Unbreakable is one of the movies on this list that just totally does feel totally incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
It's like okay, and now, you know, because I really appreciate that movie. I think that movie has such a great comic booky feel to it. There's just something about each individual shot set up and everything just looks like a frame from a comic book.
Best film.
And both of the characters, the Bruce Willis character, who finds that he's sort of invincible, and the Samuel L. Jackson character, Mr. Glass, that finds himself... He can't make a move without breaking a bone because his bones are so fragile. I'm just very curious where that relationship between the two actually went, you know, because the movie does end at a pivotal moment where they realize that their roles in the world, but then the curtain comes down on everything and you are left with a sense of, and it's not the movie's fault because I think they did plan, you know, obviously they planned to do more, but I think it's strange that Shyamalan Ding Dong is as Jamie likes to say. I think it's strange that Shyamalan didn't just get right on the horse and just go ahead and make a second one at least. I mean, maybe
not
a trilogy.
They wanted to, and it, I think it's his best work personally. But I know there was talk. I mean, I remember there was like huge talk that it was it was going to be the first of a trilogy when it came out. And I guess it did not do as well as they thought it would do, and they didn't. But yeah, I mean, and they still talk about it. Every time he has a movie coming out, people bring it up.
Yeah.
Unbreakable 2 coming. You know, you're not the only one. I mean, it's definitely something that people, there is an audience for it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it did respectably, didn't it?
Yeah,
I mean,
it did.
Do like 80 or 100 million, you know, it didn't do 200 million, but at least I think it hit at least 100. So, I mean, it didn't do too badly.
No, it didn't.
But,
I mean, I don't understand why. I mean, it is one of these things that, I don't know why. I mean, I can't tell you why. It just seems that was the, I was under the impression there was going to be that was going to be his next one. I didn't realize that the Signs and then the Village and so forth. Those I always thought there would at least be a second one, and I know Bruce. I know that everyone would come back for it. I mean, it's a very well made film.
You got to figure that the script would be good and everything like that, and it just might be the kind of thing to get Shamalian back on the horse after you know failing a couple of times, you know. With his last two or three efforts, you know.
Yeah, I don't know the first thing about this Will Smith movie that he's making, but he's made a movie with Will Smith and his son. It's a futuristic thing where I think it's an apocalyptic thing. I think.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he's probably done shooting. He's probably in editing now. But. Since that point, I mean, he's become kind of a punchline, whether that's fair or unfair. I mean, I think it's been very strange that The Last Airbender not included in this, but even something like Lady in the Water, he's a strange cat for me because his movies have kind of devolved in quality. At the same time, I think he's become a better director.
I think especially with Lady in the Water, I think you're right. Like there's something about his he's evolved as a kind of as a visual stylist and that movie for whatever you think of it, for its story flaws or whatever, or its believability or whatever, it's really beautifully directed.
It's a weird thing.
It is.
Jerry?
You're absolutely right about that. It is. He has become a punch. I mean, look, I never saw The Last Airbender. I think The Happening is the one that just sort of feels, it comes so late in the game of all those end of the world kind of movies. And it is, there's just something, I'll be the first to say, I think she's miscast. She plays an absolute freak from the moment we meet her. I mean, what does she break, a plate or something in the first scene? Drops the pipe.
I mean, I think the movie's miscast. I mean, I think everyone is just so, like, in limbo in that movie, stuck in this world of just incredible ridiculousness.
I agree.
Nobody comes off well in that
movie. No one does.
Except for maybe Betty Buckley.
Oh, okay, you think Betty Buckley. Well, okay,
well,
one scene.
As much as you possibly can come off well in that movie.
Okay.
At least she's memorable. At least she's, like, at a lunatic pitch that kind of points out to how that movie should have been played, as ridiculous as it is,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
It almost feels like she's in on the joke, but the movie isn't.
Right.
You know?
These are all very good observations about him. Lady in the Water, I won't lie to you, where I saw it, that got a standing ovation.
Well,
I mean, I'll never forget seeing the preview, and I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be great. And I still liked it.
Did you see it in, like, a school for the blind or something?
Yeah, I did see it. No, but people really liked it. I mean, I was really surprised. I mean, I just was like, okay, whatever.
It's got a lot of interesting concepts in it. But
you're right.
It's this mishmash of all this interesting stuff that just does not fit together. It just doesn't feel
right. Yeah, that's his problem. His movies feel like they're pretty well thought out. But that one shows a
does
little
not.
Cracked in the armor, yeah.
Jerry, what's another title? You got two more, right?
We're really getting to the self-indulgent mess here. This is contingent that Stanley Kubrick's newest fan, Bret Easton Ellis, write the novel first before they make the movie. I don't see how it can work otherwise, but I think given what's happened the last 10 years in the financial industry, I think a sequel is warranted for American Psycho, based on an Ellis novel, or at least a Bret Easton Ellis screenplay. Now, here's the big thing. What do you do with Patrick Bateman? How do you approach it? This is the thing. What made the movie very interesting, because the movie was at one time going to be directed by Oliver Stone. And then before that, I think Rob Weiss, who went on to do Entourage, and what's the movie he made, Amongst Friends.
Interestingly, I don't remember what order it happened in. But Oliver Stone decided it wasn't right for him either because he already felt like he covered that territory with Natural Born Killers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's what it was.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. I do think a sequel is warranted, but my thing is, what do you do with Patrick Bateman, and what is his role? I mean, he is to me kind of, he has the teeth that you would think Oliver Stone would have in the Wall Street sequel that's not there. There's no teeth. There's nothing there. So my thing is I don't want to change Patrick Bateman too much. I almost want to say I want to make him, he's gotten so far ahead in the investment banking world. Maybe he invented derivatives. Maybe his character invented derivatives. And maybe, but here's the thing, he is mainly going after women in the film, in the film book. Here's the thing. You have a storyline where you have someone who's still going after, maybe a family member or something from the first group, on the first story, who's like found out who he is and knows what he's doing, is trying to get him. But at the same time, he's like, I got to destroy the competition.
Does he get away with it at the end?
Oh, he gets away. Remember, he gets away. So I figured this is another case where we have this kind of character out there in the world, this monster. I mean, like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. You have this monster. And then they make a sequel to Henry.
What is actually ironic, and maybe this is a point of the movie, is that, I mean, those guys truly do get away with murder.
Right. They do.
There you go. But you're absolutely right. In this current capitalistic kind of environment that we're in, that would be an interesting character to go back to.
Go back and revisit. And it's interesting, you know, but, you know, this could also have the huge problem, the very huge problem that the Hannibal had when you do have this, you know, and that's tongue-in-cheek. I wasn't crazy about the book. The movie, I'm not crazy about either. But how do you, when you make that, you know, it's a fine line between satire and downright just stupidity. And it's got to be, but I think if Christian Bale came back, that's what made the Batman casting so crazy. You're going to have Patrick Bateman play Batman. At first you think, you're like, oh my God, it's the perfect choice. They're not that far apart, actually.
Yeah. Well, there's also, I mean, American Psycho also works because of the setting, because it takes place in the 80s, the decade of excess.
Right.
And it has a lot of tongue-in-cheek 80s references.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if this isn't a time of excess, what is, you know, what we're living in now?
It would have gotten worse. I think that would be, it just depends how, but it is, I would just like.
It would go from satire to, you know, a serious drama.
Yeah, that's what I'm, that's the thing. My thing is this, and I was talking about this with Kimber last night about Gordon Gekko. What does he, you know, there was a lot of ways you could have played him in the sequel, and just they sort of, and it almost seems like Oliver Stone just sort of crapped out. He were some interesting things in that movie, don't get me wrong. I think when he's coming back into the game is a great, that montage is great. And then I think the film falls apart.
Well, Wall Street 2 is a movie from an older man, an older, more resigned kind of man with regrets and that kind of thing.
Right.
It's wanting to be more reflective, and that kind of defines Oliver Stone in general now. I mean, he's the old guy that's fought the fight, and I don't see him having much fight left in him, unfortunately.
Well, we'll see. We'll see in a couple weeks with Savage.
I'd say something different if he agreed to come on the show, but he turned to Savage.
Okay. Wait, right. So that's my. But I would say with the Brett Easton Ellis, if he does do the movie, or regardless, has to come on and tell us about his newfound love for Stanley Kubrick.
Okay. Next on my list. I guess I'll go for the creme de la creme. I mean, more than anything, I want a sequel to Taxi Driver.
Yes.
Because Travis Bickle is one of the most memorable characters in the history of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely would be ravenous to see, where is Travis Bickle today? Because the movie ends, he's heralded a hero of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still freaking crazy, that Travis Bickle.
That's
you know? And it's just a matter of time before he explodes again. where would Travis Bickle be today? And they wanted to explore that. It's probably not going to happen. And you can't, I don't think you can replicate the magic of the original. So I would be cautious about it. I'd kind of wince if they announced it, but I would be endlessly fascinated to actually see it and what they choose to do with that character. I mean, do you guys have any suggestions about where Travis could be?
Well, I think you know that he might be finishing up a prison sentence and might have been away from New York for a little while, and returning back to New York to find it, you know, in comparison to the New York of the 70s, kind of rather blanded out, you know, and he might find it, you know, all the porno theaters are shut down and the.
What do you mean? I don't have a computer. What do you got? You guys are killing me here.
Yeah. 42nd Street is you know, owned by Disney now and so
yeah,
forth.
Yeah, Disney-fied.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I think that would be the most interesting way to go would be for Bickle to have been away for some reason. Maybe not a prison sentence, maybe something else. But you know, I think the prison sentence seems
that would be
most
interesting because that is such a quintessential New York movie, and New York has substantially changed in the decades since Taxi Driver took place. You know, so where would the drama come from? You know, that would be an interesting challenge.
I mean, where would you? What would he be at? Because he's such, I mean, just the monologue that he gives is just brilliant. But what would he be raging against? That's my thing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much he could be raging. But where would he? See, that's
I think it'd be very interesting if the character actually came back to New York and found it the way it is now, and found that he actually had some affection for the way it used to be, in those days where all the garbage was on the streets, and, you know, and someday a real rain is going to come and wash it away. Well,
and
a
instead
real
of being a instead of being a vigilante, instead of being
yeah.
a vigilante, he can be an anarchist, you know.
Yeah, and the real rain came, but it didn't come the way that, you know, that he saw it coming. It came in the way of corporate ownership of things, you know.
Or maybe he can find religion.
That would be
an interesting way to go. Would be a, like, sort of a spiritual journey for him as well.
Oh my God, it goes to Tibet.
I mean, I don't think
maybe he lives
him.
With the Amish. I don't know.
I don't think he would reviving his vigilante career. And you wouldn't want that anyway in the movie, because then you'd just be repeating yourself.
Well, let me ask you this. Would you bring Jodie Foster back?
Maybe. I mean, it wouldn't
Albert
be that out of the realm of possibility. Maybe. Yeah, why not?
Okay.
That would be
even make it more interesting. But I think James is right. What would you what would be his? What would be the thing that he's angry? Because he's a very angry man. So what would be his thing that he would be angry about?
Yeah, that would be an odd thing, because there'd have to be a dramatic arc involved, and I think he'd have to blow up in some way. I mean, I think something would have to occur. I mean, because that's the story of Travis Bickle. I mean, the simmering, it simmers and simmers until it finally explodes. But then again, I mean, we just talked about Oliver Stone and how he's matured in his old age and kind of mellowed. I don't know if Travis Bickle is a guy that would mellow.
I don't know, maybe, but I mean, certainly after a stay in prison, maybe not. You know, so but you have to. Face of the fact that, you know, you're right, at the end of Taxi Driver, he is still crazy, and it's only a matter of time before that bomb explodes.
You know what I think?
Here's the thing.
I think this is perfect. Hopefully I can articulate it in a minute. Travis Bickle, tortured Vietnam vet. I mean, that's where he comes from.
Yes.
And he's kind of disillusioned and informed by a lot of that stuff. You get the sense in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
What if you place him in today's world, and you see the government abuses as they are, and the controversial wars and this kind of thing.
Right, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
I can see him kind of being a vigilante against the government, like reaching a point where he's making some kind of rageful statement.
Do you think like a Timothy McVeigh kind of character?
Or more like that guy, maybe more like that guy that rammed the airplane into the side of that IRS building.
Yeah.
I could see that being his arc, that being where he is today. Actually,
That's a very interesting idea.
And that movie is the assassination of Richard Nixon.
that's absolutely right, but. You bring up, it's very interesting to bring up Scorsese, because Scorsese did make one of the greatest sequels to a movie that had been from long ago, and that's The Color of Money.
Mm-hmm.
He really, more so than any other director, coming with someone else's material, and just came in and made a solid film about a beloved character, and... He did it better than people who come back after a long hiatus with their own creations.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
Yeah, we don't give that film enough credit, I think, sometimes, but it really is quite an astounding feat what he did there. He is doing exactly what we're talking about doing tonight, essentially. He did
it. Yeah.
Okay, we'll go through one more round, and then we'll bring on Kimber and go through the choices a little bit faster to close off the show.
Okay.
But Dean, it's your turn.
One of my favorite movies of the past few years was released in 2001 by Kenneth Lonergan, and it's called You Can Count on Me. And if you haven't seen it, it tells the story of this normal bank manager played by Laura Linney, who's living single with her child. Played by Kieran Culkin, or is it Rory Culkin? I get all the Culkins.
I forget. I get all the Culkins mixed up.
She gets visited by her wayward brother, who's initially visits just to get money to take care of what I think is his girlfriend, who's needs an abortion. I think, but it's never stated in the movie why he needs the money. And he comes back and visits and sort of reconnects with her in this small New England town that he says, even though he's from there, he says that, there's nothing there for him. At the end of the film, he ends up, going back out on the road to continue, wrapping up business that he has, and maybe revisiting old places that he thought he had found happiness for just a little bit. But I would very much welcome a return to these characters. I think these were characters that Lonergan had lived with for a long time, because it was based on a stage play, and I think even Lenny and Mark Ruffalo, who plays the brother, had played these characters on stage before and had done extensive improvisations in these characters. So I think if you got these actors back and you got Lonergan back on, I think the natural things would start happening, and actually, the story would reveal itself. The story, of course, obviously the brother would have to come back into her life. And I'd just like to be—I'd like to be informed as to what these people are doing now. I really feel like these are very live, alive characters, living small lives, yes, but they are—they just seem incredibly real, like just like those characters in All the Real Girls. That's the thing, all of these movies just have such great characters that they just feel like they just cannot be left alone,
Okay.
And for me, You Can Count on Me is just absolutely my number one movie that I would want to see.
It's a great choice.
To.
It's an awesome choice, Dean. All the choices that you guys have brought up have been great, but that was not what I would think of. But you're right. They are very authentic characters, and I would like to, you know, catch up with them.
Yeah. I mean, it's really just that simple. I mean, I wouldn't know exactly what they would be doing. I wouldn't want to know. I'd just rather just leave it up to those actors and that director, writer-director, to figure it out. But I do think that it would be an incredibly natural.
Go ahead. No, Jerry, it's your turn.
It's my turn. Okay, and this is sort of, I guess, the film and book that started all this in one sense, because... And, of course, you know, oh, by the way, American Psycho, my mom was like, you're really not going to pick that, are you? I'm like, yeah, I am. She's like, oh, my God. She's like, just shut up. Okay, I'm going to read the last couple of lines of this book. But, Jamie, this is really sort of like along the lines of why Taxi Driver. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it. And you'll know from the first line I'm going to read what this is. And no groans in the chat room or all you people, all my friends listening on this, because you all know what it is. We miss you, Mr. Durden, or somebody with a broken nose pushes a mop past me and whispers, everything's going according to the plan. Whispers, we're going to break up civilization so we can make something better out of the world. Whispers, we look forward to getting you back. And with those words, I would love Chuck Palahniuk to go back right now. I like everything that he's written. Well, almost everything. Pygmy sucked. But I like everything that he's written, but I'd like him to write the official sequel to Fight Club. Before anything else is done, I would like to see what happens to the narrator, Ed Norton, in middle age. I would like to see how this character copes, especially at the end of the film and the book. I'd like to see, does his imaginary friend, his Hobbs, come back and manifest himself in this in Brad Pitt? I would really welcome all this. But, you know, it's like what you said about how would Travis Bickle react to the world today? Well, how would these characters react to the world that is in a book that was, for its time, way ahead of it and predicted a lot of things in an eerie way and in an interesting way. But, you know, it's very interesting. When Kim Morgan was talking about The Social Network, she said in many ways it was a sequel to David Fincher's Fight Club in many ways. And I always found that to be interesting. I would just want to see how this character functions in the world of today. And for no other reason, I just would like to see what he's doing. I want to see, it's a movie and a book about not wanting to grow up. Besides, I think also a very homoerotic book and movie. I would just like to see how everything works today. What's this guy doing? Can he exist? And also his relationship with Marla Singer, they were made for each other, it turns out. But I would just really want to see how this character just exists in the world today. I'm more than anything else, just his reaction, his commentary. But I would like with Brady Snell's, we would need Chuck to write the book first before any idea of it. I would even accept the sequel. I would just like to see the book and then the film.
Yeah.
Everyone from the original film. Now, of course, we're talking about a movie that was a box office disaster. I mean, a movie that the most expensive cult movie ever made. And it, you know, I don't think anyone's going to be eager to. This is going to be where the, what is her name, Megan Ellison, the Oracle heiress, she's going to have to confront this, put up the money for it. But I really would, and I know it's anticlimactic because I talked about this when we mentioned this thing about sequels, but I really just would love to see this. More than any of these other things, I mean, this is really what this was all about, going to this particular book and movie to see it come together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a wise choice.
Yeah.
I was kind of expecting that title to come up. And
yeah, you knew. I mean, it's me. I mean, my mom.
Very
like,
appropriate. That
you know what,
my mom? Yeah.
My mom was like, great, you're going to bring that up too? You know, she's like, really? Can you shut up about that movie?
All right, my pick, and then we'll pick up Kimber's line. This is another film that they plan to make a sequel to, actually a trilogy. And so obviously it won't happen. But it would have been fascinating had it happened. And that's Chinatown, the third in the series. The first one was about water. The second one was about oil, the two Jakes. And the third one was supposed to be about air? Which that never got off the ground because the second one was such a debacle.
Let's talk about this because this, I think, was on all three of our. I think all three of us were thinking about this. I think I know I was. So
yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know. With I guess that would be an environmental slant. I guess.
Where would you have it take place in the 60s? Obvious, maybe the 60s or.
When is the second one?
The
second one's
the
50s.
Maybe
right?
The 70s.
The 70s. That would
maybe
be.
How about the during the Watts riots or something like that?
Well, that's an interesting. These are all this. I mean, I agree with Jamie. I mean, we were all hoping. You know, with. There's a huge. You bring up a thing about the two. I do like the Two Jakes. I don't love the Two Jakes, but I want to like it, and I kind of was hoping that maybe someone would find it in their hearts to make the third one, but that's never going to happen. I agree with you, Jamie. I would go buy my ticket tonight if that was.
And I think the main reason why it's not happening or it never did happen. It's because there's just so much bad more so than the movie not performing, the Two Jakes, but there's so much
bad
blood. Yeah. I mean, that movie was just, I mean, that really teetered, that really destroyed a couple of friendships and relationships, that movie.
I mean, you're talking about the friendships between, say, Jack Nicholson and Robert Towne, maybe, or Robert
and
Evans?
Well, Nicholson is known as, like, having great friends that he keeps and takes care of his entire life. And Robert Towne and Nicholson don't really speak that much anymore. It all stemmed from the Two Jakes. I mean, he still doesn't like to talk about it. Robert Evans and Nicholson are still extremely close. I mean, Nicholson wanted to cast Robert Evans in the role that ultimately went to Harvey Keitel.
That's right.
But Evans was just in a really bad place in his life at the time, and he just couldn't do it, didn't want to do it, and Robert Towne really didn't want to do it, I don't think. But and Nicholson kind of came in as a life support. He didn't want to direct it. I think Towne was going to direct it. And so Nicholson said, okay, fine, I'll freaking direct it. Let's just get this thing made. Let's just get this over with. And I think that's the unfortunate thing you feel in the movie.
Feel that way.
Yeah.
But it's a great choice.
Yeah,
so
there's
a tension
in that movie.
There's a something. I mean, I think that was on all of our minds. I mean, that is the great. That is the, you know, you talk about. I mean, Unbreakable and Mystery Men. I definitely see, and even Taxi Driver is one of the great unmade sequels. But the third Jake Gittes movie is really the greatest. Unmade.
Yeah.
I would like I said, I'd go buy a ticket tonight. I really would. I would love to see that.
Let's buy a ticket, maybe.
Yeah, buy a ticket, maybe I'll do it.
Do you have advanced tickets on sale? I know the Dark Knight Rises are already on sale, but how about for the third Chinatown film? You got those on sale yet?
And I think there's also another reason, and we'll probably talk about this in a couple minutes. Anyway, when you do leave a series or a movie, the gaps in between. It is hard to retain, for the most part, that freshness. It's hard to recapture that magic. And we see it, it's obviously the Star Wars and the last Indiana Jones movie suffer from that, in a way. And as much as I do like The Godfather 3, I think it's grown on me, there's no doubt that the spark, that creative magic,
I agree.
Is gone.
I agree. And part of me feels like, and we talked about this before in terms of Godfather 3, Coppola was at a place where we just talked about Oliver Stone being at when he made Godfather 3, like a man looking back at his life with regret, and he's mellowed and remorse and all of that kind of stuff. And I understand the Shakespearean kind of dimensions of that.
Right.
But at the same time, there was such a lapse between the second and third movie that it didn't feel like the world of Michael. And I understand that the character can mature, but it didn't feel like any remnants of Michael was in there for me. And I love his performance in it, but it's almost like a completely different kind of performance from...
I think Dave Huberman's review in The Village Voice, he just thought it was more at the end of the day. This is always, I mean, he liked it. I mean, not as much as Janet Maslin or Siskel and Ebert, but he did like it. But he said this is always going to be considered a footnote to the other two movies.
And Pacino himself said I don't think that was the right direction for the character. Like in an interview I read of his a couple of years ago, I think it was a mistake to have Michael seek remorse for his wrongdoings. I didn't think that was the right direction for it.
You know, the big death knell for that was when Robert Duvall dropped out. I really do believe that when he would have turned on Michael, and that would have made an explosive third and final film.
I agree with that completely.
By taking him out and putting, I mean, no offense, Mr. Tan, George Hamilton, it's just B.J. Harrison is the same character. I mean,
and it really kills you about that movie too. That the only reason they didn't have Duvall in it is they didn't want to pay his price. They should have just gone ahead and paid his price.
Yes.
No, they really didn't. There was no.
And that was a big mistake.
And I think there are really, obviously, I mean, I think Andy Garcia's performance is incredible in that movie. I think he's a great, because he reminds us so much of the old man and Sonny. He has that in him, and that's obviously a very welcome, especially in the second half of the film. I mean, there's no grout. There's some great touches. I mean, I was explaining, you know, there are other ways this movie could have gone with Sylvester Stallone and Eddie Murphy at one time. So this is the, how should I say it, the least bad version of this that could have been made.
That was on the table.
Even Puzo, what he was writing.
That's a great compliment to the movie. Well,
no,
the least,
I do like it. Even what Puzo
it's
was.
It's the least bad version you could have come up with.
Yeah,
so congratulations.
Puzo had at one point before Coppola came on board, they had Puzo that the CIA and the mafia would go in and assassinate like a South American drug lord. That was a possible storyline, and I think that was when Michael Eisner was like championing it. There's so many different storylines, and I just got done reading the Family Corleone book that just came out. That would have been the Godfather Part 4 that they were going to do.
Well, I think keep it in the family, you know, I think so. That was good, but the fourth one actually, Coppola talked about that. Like he had talked to Puzo. And they're actually talking about casting and everything, and DiCaprio. And
that was DiCaprio was going to play Sonny.
Yeah.
But I
got to
tell you, after reading it, I'm glad that maybe it's wise they never made it, because it, you know, we speak about it just feels like a footnote.
Well, let's be honest, the Godfather novel is not the Godfather movie. I mean, he really made Shakespeare out of pulp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? He didn't want it. He thought it was Harold Robbins like kind of thing when he was offered. He threw the book in the trash. I mean,
Let's bring on Kimber to join the last bit of this conversation. Hey, Kimber, I hope this is you.
Hi.
Okay.
Hey, Kimber.
I'm skittish about taking callers.
Put that other guy on.
Yeah. It's a relief to hear you.
Great.
We're all right. All right, so what do you got?
I have to say that the chat is on fire tonight. Wow, that was like crazy. I don't know if you guys were on it, but man, some people were a little nutty.
I think a lot of people like went to the chat room around the time that obscene caller called in because he got all of his friends and they were going to call one right after another. I think that's what was going to happen.
But, oh, really?
We foiled them.
Good.
All right, give me one of your picks, Kimber.
Okay, well, Jerry has already alluded to this, but him and I had a wonderful conversation, and I really, really wanted to do you proud, Jamie, because you were like, "Hey, you can do a list," and I'm like, "Oh, giddy about it," and I'm like, "Yeah, I'm gonna be a badass list, and it's gonna be the best ever." And so I started thinking of all these movies, right? And I'm, like, thinking of all my favorite films, and I'm, like, imagining, you know, okay, what would the sequel be like? And I'm, like, nope, I don't like that. No, I don't like that either. Oh, shit. What do I have here? And that's what came to my conclusion, which Jerry and I talked about, is that I'm done with sequels, and that's where I stand. I'm done with the remakes. I'm done with sequels. And I think you guys did a fabulous job on your show tonight, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think that basically you guys had already hinted at this, is that, how can I put this? Like, when you have an original film and you have it in its wrong form and we all fall in love with that film, and, of course, we want to know what happens at the end. But and I believe Dean said this. he said, well, you kind of want to have that suspense and that thought in your mind, because there's nothing like what your mind can compute.
Mm-hmm.
And so mine's going to be totally different than yours. And then I'm left with that love affair of that last film, that first film, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What
yeah. Yeah,
yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, you feel like it would taint the magic of the experience of the original in some way. There's always
exactly.
that danger.
I mean, Jerry and I were talking about Pretty Woman, for example. And, you know, that's one of those films that a lot of women, and I think even men, love that film. But when you really look at it, yeah, at the end they find, you know, love, and they go off and they run in the sunset. But then if you take those two characters, and you take Richard Gere's character and you take Julie Roberts' character, and you realize that they're both from the extreme versions of the side of the spectrum, of background, of culture. And you have to go, okay, in real life, let's be realistic here. Would this, quote, love affair last?
Would it last? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so if you did do a sequel, in essence, you know, what would it be like? Would it be the truth? Of us, you know, would the sequel be like
imagine
reality?
It would be less of the fairy tale, you know. Would it be? Because that's the thing about that movie is that it has that fairy tale quality to it.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, the first one is kind of a fable that wasn't really interested in the truth necessarily, but it works because it's a fable. It's a fairy tale, like Dean said. But I mean, so I'm sure that the second one would follow suit, but there's no drama in that because, you know, the opposites have already attracted. You know?
Yeah.
In the first one.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I gotcha. I feel you. Yeah.
I mean,
why
imagine,
are we agreeing right now?
The only reason to do a sequel would be to get Julia Roberts naked. And there's no way she's going to do that. So.
That's true.
You would want her naked now?
Richard Gere would get naked, I'm sure.
Naked before the camera started rolling.
Hey, here's the sequel. Maybe Julia Roberts brings home a gerbil, and it brings...
it brings back terrible memories.
Pretty gerbil. Okay.
Oh, my God.
But, I mean, you know, there's also the danger. You don't want a sequel that repeats itself either. You know, you don't want a sequel to taint the memory of the original. That's, of course, the number one danger. But then you also don't want just the same movie, you know, but just different, you know.
Good point, Dean. That's a really good point. Because there you get a thing, though. I guess you would call it a polarizing effect, where you have people who will be like, oh, they just the same, like The Hangover 2. It's exactly, we were talking about this last night. This is why maybe there shouldn't be a sequel to Anchorman, because they might fumble and do the same, you know, make the same mistakes as, I think, The Hangover 2, where you just change the locale, really. But,
but if you do
something so different, that monkey had a good agent. But if you do something too different, and we've all witnessed this, then people get up in arms, because it's not like, you know, it's nothing, you know, you can't please everyone with it.
I mean, that's like Prometheus for me, you know.
No, well, that's just a common thing I've heard about Prometheus.
And we're going to see that with Taken 2. I mean, it gets ridiculous. I mean, I looked at the trailer to Taken 2, and I thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is like seven seasons of that show 24. How many times will he have to solve a crime in 24 hours? You know, how many times is this guy going to get kidnapped or have a loved one kidnapped? Or
his dog gets kidnapped in the next movie.
That's the thing that's kept me from watching 24, because, you know, I think I watched that first season and I was like, you know, it's fine. I'm just leaving it at that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, seven seasons of it, come on, that's ridiculous.
It got old after a while, but I'm telling you, the second season is pretty ballsy. Second season is my favorite.
Yeah.
But,
what do you guys feel about sequels with, like, all these Marvel comics and the DC comics? Do you think that this is a good thing or a bad thing or what?
Well, I think the Avengers is the thing that's the game changer, because it was smart. But where do you go after that? That's my question. How do you top the Avengers? That's the question.
It's a good thing in that it's keeping Hollywood alive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the money. It's the lifeblood of Hollywood right now.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought this? I mean, really. I mean, if you really think about it. I mean,
But they just want the same experience.
Before, but it's for it to be this much of a blockbuster. I think, what, Avengers is still the number one right now for blockbusters and opening weekend and stuff. It's just like, it's unreal to me that something so geeky has become mainstream.
It was smart, though. You put all these different characters from all these different films, and you got all the fans of each of the films, and that way I think...
Right.
I didn't think this was... I thought it would do well, but that it would do this well, it astounds me. I love the film, and I would like to see it again. I wanted to go back. There was talk a couple of years ago, a sequel to The Last Detail, and I guess that fizzled.
You can make sequels to every Nicholson movie from the 70s.
I would love to see one of the King of Marvin Garden ones. I'd like to see.
I mean, the Five Easy Pieces, and like we discussed months ago, and then The Last Detail and Chinatown and
Carnal Knowledge.
Every movie except for Cuckoo's Nest. Like, where's the Chief?
Yeah.
Where did the Chief run to at Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be an unusual sequel.
And, of course, Stephen King has written the sequel to The Shining.
We talked about that.
An unbearably bad idea called Dr. Sleep, which follows the kid, which just sounds like a complete dud. I mean,
I gotta be honest with you. That does not sound. It doesn't sound promising.
But you know,
Is it out yet?
He's finished writing it. I think it's probably his next book that he's going to release. But
okay,
you know, they'll make a movie out of it. They make a movie out of every bowel movie that Stephen King makes. You know, so
oh my God.
So Jerry, did you have any more that you want to list real quick? Because I know Dean.
We talked about this last night. It is a movie many years ago I would really love to see a sequel to, in all seriousness, but I don't know how you could do it now because the main character is a complete loon. That's To Kill a Sunrise. I would have welcomed this, but there's no way today that you would believe Mel Gibson as that character. There's an innocence about that's just not there. There's a nice quality. And I don't mean to use, because we talked about how unfairly Tom Cruise was judged by his, and all he did was jump up and down on the sofa. I mean, it's not like he called anyone sugar tits or said the Jews were responsible for all the wars in the world. I was in the 90s. I would have welcomed that. I would have been loved to see Robert Towner, because it's one of my favorite Kurt Russell performances, and I'd like to see the whole cast get back, and I would like to see where those characters are. But there's just no way. There's no way anyone is going to believe Mel Gibson as that character now.
Well, you know, Robert Towner does not like the way he ended that movie.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he thinks that he ended it the wrong way.
Oh, okay.
That being said,
that's a very interesting. Okay.
That being said, I can't remember the way it ends.
I can't either, and I just watched
she,
it.
She dies, right?
No, Raul Julia. We can't bring him back in either way.
Oh no, I think he originally planned to have her die.
Oh, okay.
But they did. They wanted them to ride off in the sunset together. It was a studio call.
Right.
Okay.
And
am I still on or?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you muted me.
No.
I thought I was done. Oh, okay.
No. You're good.
Interject in here. They're literally in the sunset at the beginning at the end of that movie, like in the ocean or whatever. I remember.
I call the sequel Margarita Moon. I think that's
I thought we already had a sequel to this movie that you're discussing, or am I being retarded?
No sequel.
No.
I thought there was a sequel.
Nope.
Even though The Passion of Christ is kind of a semi-sequel.
Maybe I'm just thinking of like Cocktails or something, like Tequila Sunrise, Tequila Sunset. Maybe I'm just being kind of a drunk right now. I don't know.
Yeah, the sequel to Cocktail was, I think, Leaving Las Vegas, wasn't it? Or was it?
Let me ask you this, Jamie, because we did bring it up. There are books. There is a sequel to Wild at Heart. Would you welcome that if everyone came back?
Well, in an ideal world, yes. But the main drawback of that is essentially David Lynch isn't that filmmaker anymore.
Right.
Who knows what the hell David Lynch is anymore?
Okay.
I don't think he's remotely interested in that, which is another movie on my list, which is the the obvious, the most obvious movie that everyone's screaming for a sequel to, which is The Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
But the Coen brothers do not want to return to that well. I mean, that's not going to happen.
Right, yeah.
And you can see The Big Lebowski being a one-off. You know, that's a very special kind of entity unto itself.
Right.
But, you know, who doesn't want to see more of the
dude?
Well,
I don't know. The thing, though, now, it's kind of like the same thing as if you've seen the movie The Boondock Saints. And that movie didn't really do well. And it became, like, ultimately a kind of, like, for lack of a better word, a cult classic.
Yeah.
Fan base brought the sequel.
Yeah.
And so they did it, it was shit. I didn't like it.
No, it was horrible.
But my point is that even though they're saying, no, we're not going to do that, I'm never going to repeat. Well, don't hold your breath on that one, because I think, you know, if you have enough of a fan base that is like, hey, I'm crazy for this sequel, you never know. And the thing is if you do follow with Boondock Saints, though, they almost destroyed it. It was just like such a huge turnoff when you saw that.
Like,
I'm going to vomit it in my mouth.
It took itself too seriously, I thought. You know.
Well, the thing about the Coen brothers don't give a shit. I mean,
right.
they do not want to make it. You also run the risk of...
Don't give a shit.
You also run the risk... I mean, it's such an eccentric thing unto itself, The Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what would a sequel be? It would almost, like, play, like, The Further Adventures of the Dude. And then it becomes, like, an Abbott and Costello thing. You know, what's he going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, is he going to meet Frankenstein in the next one? You know, it'll become something... not as special as that original movie.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a big problem
that's
here.
That's the danger with that.
That's
kind
of my point about sequels,
though. I don't think that they could reheat that souffle. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, I just don't think that they could do it.
How long did you work on that analogy?
That analogy.
They just can't do it. I mean, it's like...
You can't recook a Pop-Tart, let me tell you.
No.
Now I want a Pop-Tart.
All right, so Dean, you had more movies on your list. List them real quick.
I mean, this seems obvious to me. Ghost World.
That's a really good one.
Yeah, I mean, since there's so much material that Daniel Close could actually pull from the comics that deal with Enid, it seems natural that Ghost World could easily be done. I think the one that comes furthest away from, you know, I mean, I'm talking in terms of time now, is on my list is The Jerk.
I love that movie.
That's an awesome movie, but how would you talk about
the
recapturing
too,
the magic?
Right? They made The Jerk, too.
But it didn't have him in it, did he?
Right.
That's not a real... That's a pseudo
They did
sequel.
The Jerk 2 without The Jerk. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, that was wrong. So, I mean, we just go... Just act like that doesn't exist. But really, seriously, bring back Steve Martin as Maven Johnson.
You have to bring him.
And just, you know, that's the only way it's going to be a sequel. Another film that I love, and unfortunately it's been adapted into a pretty bad animated series now, but I always thought that Napoleon Dynamite deserved a sequel. And I had this whole idea of, maybe the cast is getting a little old, too old to play it now, I guess, but I regret that, you know, they didn't just hop on that train immediately and have Napoleon, maybe go to a dance contest somewhere in the biggest city in where is it? It's shot in Idaho, I think. So, the biggest city in Idaho, Boise or something, and go visit the big city, you know. So,
is that show really that bad? The animated series, is it really that?
It's pretty poor. I mean, you know, the thing about that movie is that a lot of the humor comes from the slow cadence of the dialogue in it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the television show is extremely caffeinated. I mean, it's just barreling right on through, just one joke after another, because it has, it's trying to do that same thing that, you know, all animated shows do after The Simpsons. It's just
That gives me a thought. Do we need another Beavis and Butthead movie?
Maybe.
Maybe.
Why not?
Can't hurt.
Why not? I like the first one a lot.
Yeah, the first one's very, has some very funny moments.
Can they bring back the show, too?
Yes, yeah. I watched the first couple of episodes, and then I kind of lost track of it.
Well, how's the show doing?
But, you know, for me, though,
I don't know how it's doing.
I think it did spectacularly well the first couple of episodes. But for me, the movie was so much more successful than the show ever was,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I agree. That's
like
a rare
White House
thing,
score.
Too.
That's true, because
yeah.
I know people who didn't really particularly care for the show but loved the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're not inundated with them sitting and having to watch music videos and promote MTV.
And that's the thing that is the thing that switches you off from the TV show sometimes, is, you know, you don't want to sit through the videos.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing on my list is The Rocketeer. Maybe not a sequel, but maybe a reboot. But I
can
always
see that happening.
Have you guys seen The Professional yet?
Yes.
The movie, The Professional?
They talked about making a sequel. They're still talking about that. You hear that?
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Because I watched that recently. I mean, I've seen it before, but it just reminded me of, like, what a great film that was. And I was like, oh, maybe a sequel might be kind of interesting. But now it goes back to what we were talking about before. It's like, it's been kind of a while now.
It's been like 18 years now. So
yeah. I think that's a good choice.
You know, it is. I was thinking about that. But I know Natalie Portman is asked from time to time. And she does say, oh, they're working on it. You know, there's something, there is talk that there is a sequel.
What is the movie that they're writing right now? God, it'll come to me, I hope, because this guy is always asked about this movie, and he says they're writing it right now, and he's been saying that for years. Oh, God, this is going to bother me, because it's such a cult movie, and they want to make another one. I can't even think about it. I'll have to let you guys talk, and I'll think about it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I only have three more movies on my list. Another one is pretty obvious. Before Sunset, I think they need to return to those characters again.
I thought there was it was a trilogy. They do it every 10 years or something.
I don't know. Is that true?
Before Sunrise is 1994. Before Sunset, if I'm not mistaken, isn't that 2004 or?
That's what I was thinking.
Somewhere
I
around
thought
there.
This was a sequel.
It was supposed to be, they did say it was a trilogy, I think, so they were going to come back do it again.
Okay, well, that's good. I mean, that's good.
Nobody
they really need to
me
do
on
that.
I'm listening to you.
What'd you say?
What'd you say?
I was saying it earlier, and you guys said cocktail, and I was like, no, what Dina said earlier about this movie, about the Before Sunset. I was like, I thought this was already a sequel.
Oh,
and you guys
said
it
is a sequel.
Like, no.
It's the second one, yeah. Before Sunset is the second one. Mm-hmm. It's the first
Talk
one is Before Sunrise. Yeah.
They are making another one of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they are, because Ethan Hawke just said it a couple of weeks ago that they're about to shoot it.
I guess they're not making a sequel to The Woman
around.
In the Pit.
Oh, good. Well, I get my wish immediately. That's awesome. Monsters, Inc. Pixar doesn't do many sequels to their own movies, strangely enough. They've done a Cars 2, but why wouldn't they go back and revive those characters in Monster, Inc.?
They're doing a prequel. I saw an advertisement in front of Brave for Monsters University. They're doing a prequel, though.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah,
that's what that is.
I'm not pulling your leg. I'm telling absolutely.
No,
obviously,
you're
somebody
true.
Thought it was a good idea. They're doing it. So there you go. You got your wish, Dean.
God, twice, Dean. Twice.
Twice in a row.
Twice.
Okay, well, let's see. Finally on my list, I'm waiting for the next Master and Commander movie.
There was talk, Dean, because... I had heard of, this is many years ago, but when the ships, you know, they you know, would give tours of the ships they use, you know, and a person who went on a trip to go see it said they wouldn't allow them to say to go actually on a ship because they're going to use it for, they were planning on making another one. So there is. I mean, I hope it's so expensive, though. I think at the time, I don't know if they're rushing to do it. I wish they would. It's one of my favorite Russell Crowe films.
And it did well at the box office.
Yes, it
did well critically. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't, you know. And they've got the material, so.
So can I say one? I figured one out.
Okay.
Yeah.
That I want a sequel to, because you guys mentioned Ethan Hawke, and it made me think of one of my favorite movies with him. And it came out when I was a kid. I was a teenager. And the film was focused more on they just graduated college. And I just thought they were so cool. And if I could just be just like them, and they talk so smart, you know, and they were just like so fabulous. And I think with this film, it's called Reality Bites, by the way.
Yeah, I would welcome that.
And if they did a sequel on that, where would they be today, kind of thing? Like, are they still so idealistic? Are they still, you know, hopeful in life? Where did life take them? Did they pursue their dreams?
Mm-hmm.
Did they not pursue their dreams? That sort of thing. I think that would be a
very good choice. I mean, that's along
the line.
Like the Breakfast Club kind of sequel.
Yeah, kind of like that.
That's a very good choice. That's a very underrated movie.
Would you do a sequel to a John Hughes movie?
I would never do it. You would be crucified. I mean,
well, that would be a trick.
I mean, I don't
how
see
can,
how
can we bring back John Hughes for this movie?
There's one thing you've got to say about John Hughes is only he could make his movies. He had a very, it's what we said when he passed away, he knew how to speak to teenagers. Unlike anyone else before. I mean, you have to give that to him. And
but then again, I mean, what kind of a bore fest would Ferris Bueller's Day Off be if they made a sequel to it today?
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that movie is so much about about youth, kind of the exhilaration of youth and that kind of thing. I mean, that would kind of really defeat the purpose to do a sequel. Whereas Ferris as an adult man, he'd probably be a bum.
Not be the guy.
It's hard. He'd be one of the guys peddling at that parade that
he
sang at like 30 years earlier.
He'd be the dude.
He'd be the dude.
I love it.
Yeah, right. And Matthew Broderick is—I always say—he's such a fuddy-duddy now. Like, he doesn't have Ferris Bueller in him anymore.
No, I mean, what was that movie, Tower Heist? I mean, you know, you're right. He is a fuddy-duddy. You're right.
Yeah.
I will say this too. I got another one.
Okay.
I really, really, really don't want them to stop the Batman. I'm like in love with the bat, and I really don't want.
Well, they're not coming back.
Making this film.
Who would you want to play Batman then? Who do you want to play Batman?
I don't even really care who plays Batman. I just don't want them to stop the movies. I'm like obsessed. It's like ever since. I mean, okay, I will admit this. Adam West. Okay, fine. You know, I'm a kid. I'm watching Adam West. I fell in love with Batman. It's been like this love affair ever since. You know, and it's like. And then what Nolan did with Batman is just like, oh, my God, it just blows my mind how he was able to take something that, okay, I'm probably going to get shit for this, but something kind of corny and made it into something of reverence and made it into something powerful and dramatic, gave it more life and human. It's more human, more of a human story.
Yeah.
And
you're talking about the Christopher Nolan, right? The Christopher Nolan one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't want him to stop. And he's saying he's stopping July 20th when it opens. That's the last one, and I'm just like,
that's
totally
the last one for him.
That does not mean, though. Now, we might finally, in a couple of years, Darren Aronofsky may finally get to do his.
Well, it's going to be rebooted. I mean,
he's
Nolan,
film, because, I mean, it's four or five trailers we've got.
Well, Nolan said, you know, I have ended this on a definitive note, so they can feel free to reboot it now. They don't continue what I've done with it. They just reboot it.
Mm.
Which is another reason why I think he dies at the end of this one. But there you go.
Wow.
Well, I got to tell you something, Jamie.
They can't
you are in a way, man. You are on to something because one of the things they've used, Nightfall is one of the stories they're using, and another one, I think, Gangland, where Gotham City descends into the gangs control a large portion of Gotham. But the other one they are claiming is an influence is Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's now there's a lot of stuff they want they obviously aren't putting into the movie from that. But
we are getting a sequel to Top Gun, which who didn't want the continuation of that story?
Is Val Kilmer coming back?
We are getting a sequel to Serenity.
I really want to see again. Yes.
Yeah, Serenity, whatever that is.
Can I just say this about Top Gun? I mean, I like it and everything, but Goose is gone. Like, I mean, when he died, there was like an element, in my opinion, of the movie that kind of died. I mean, he was like
a
comic relief.
Good point, yeah.
When you lose the heart,
are you gonna have another Goose? Are you gonna have another Goose?
Well, maybe his apparition
never expected.
Like Obi-Wan Kenobi or something.
Maybe they'll replace him. Maybe they'll replace him with a pelican. I don't know. I don't know what they'll do with it.
Is Tom Cruise coming back for Top Gun, or
Yes, he is.
So what is the
Kelly McGillis is coming back for the sequel too. She's actually playing Tom Skerritt.
That's so wrong.
Oh,
man. Why do you have to call back in?
A lot of people love the idea of having a sequel to Big Trouble in Little China. I watched that movie again last night.
I almost watched that last night. That's crazy.
Can I bring up something?
Yeah.
I love that movie, and I wish that he would go back and remake Escape from L.A. because I was really disappointed with that, and I was looking forward to that for so long, and I was just so disappointed in that.
I really wanted
that to be so good. But there's also a case. There's also a case. What we've been talking about the whole time, what we talked about last night, was, and you wait so long. The magic's just not there, the freshness. I know a lot of people have a soft spot for Escape from L.A., but I was just, I don't know, I was expecting something just so, you know, obviously otherworldly that wasn't there. But I would love for him to go back and try it again.
Yeah.
But no one's going to do that.
What about the Goonies?
That's a tough one. I don't know. Unless you get everyone to
come back. I can see that as a reboot, but not as a sequel. I just don't see how, you know, what are you going to do? Like the kids as adults, I just don't see that as being anything interesting. But then again, the appeal of the Goonies, you know, kind of eludes me in some ways. I'm not quite sure what it's all about.
I think the Goonies is more. I think more so than people actually thinking it's a great movie. I think it's just kids nostalgic for their childhood.
Yes, I'll agree with that.
Because I came out of my generation, and it's purely nostalgia on that movie.
I agree with you 100% on that, Jamie.
Anything with Forrest Gump?
Well, they wrote a sequel to it, so I mean, there's a book, a Winston Groom, but I
wouldn't be bad, I guess.
I used to love Forrest Gump a lot more than I do now. Back in maybe the late 90s, I would have said, yes, they must do a sequel to it. But now I'm not so sure.
Well, let me just bring up
one. I love
how
that movie is named.
One of our loyal fans is in the chat room, Kashik, and he said on a post on our show, actually on Blog Talk Radio, he left District 9. Well, I have to say, of any movie recently that does warrant a sequel, I would be very interested to. I think he brings up a good point. That does warrant a sequel, the way that ends.
Yeah,
I would not mind.
Like it.
I think that was actually a very good choice on his part, too. To make this fine, for sure.
I mean, you know, it does feel like it has more to say.
A lot more, I think, yeah. So I thought that was a wonderful choice on his part. But as far that's the most recent thing that I actually could see. Yeah, let's go ahead and do a sequel. I could definitely see that. I would not mind seeing it in a couple of years. He comes back and does that.
I bet that will happen eventually.
No Dick Tracy sequel. I mean, that's not going to happen.
I sort of love that movie, you know. I haven't gone back and revisited it in a long time, but I I remember seeing it on the big screen and just being taken away by its look and feel and everything, more than anything else.
Let me ask a big, an odder question. A book, you know, there's the movie Catch-22, and then Joseph Heller wrote a sequel in the 90s called Closing Time. Would anybody welcome that being made into a movie? Or do we not think Catch-22 worked as well as a movie? Were there the warning?
Well, I think they would be. I think Catch 22 should be remade. First of all,
okay. Now, if you remake it, and it is, would you go ahead and adapt the sequel, Closing Time?
Yeah, but only after the remake.
Okay, so you wouldn't do a straight sequel right now because, I mean, talk. No one, first of all, is probably the today's movie going audience might is probably. Now, I'm sure they might have read the book or at least heard of it, but I doubt they've seen the movie.
Yeah, I don't think so.
That was just one I wrote down.
As much as I love some parts of Catch-22, and I think that it's a fascinating, huge, overblown production, and it's great to see that massive cast in it and everything, I do think there's problems with it. I haven't read the original book, so I don't know how close it follows it or whatever, but I suspect that it strays from it quite a bit. And there's just, there's the seeds of a good movie in there, but not nearly as great as the reputation that the book has.
Right.
So I definitely think that's something that needs to be remade.
That's something for another show. So has Jamie thought of that movie from 20
yes.
minutes ago that you were going to think of?
It just occurred to me, Midnight Run.
Oh.
I would definitely.
I mean,
I didn't say anything.
That's right.
We've been talking about that.
Yeah. So here's two more, because I'm looking at EW's list, and this is these are good choices. Out of Sight, to see those two characters together again.
Well, there is a sort of a sequel with that character. Well, a couple of Leonard characters, a book called Road Dogs that came out a couple of years ago. I would love to see that.
Bull Durham.
Yeah.
Bull Durham.
Oh, my God, a good Kevin Costner movie. No, I like The Company Man, The Upside of Anger, but I would love to see a sequel to Bull Durham. I think that'd be great.
Yeah, maybe that could work, yeah. They're way past their prime. They can't be in baseball anymore, for God's sake. I mean, they're 50 years old or whatever now, so what would they be doing? But manager,
maybe he's a coach. Maybe a coach or a manager.
Maybe a senior league.
There you go. That's a good...
Oops, I crapped my pants. Maybe that could be the title.
All right, here's one more. Going back to Nicholson. About Schmidt. There are two Schmidt books that follow that. And granted, they changed the character. They watered the character down, but I would welcome another Schmidt movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Two more books, one that just came out, but I wouldn't be against that.
Yeah, I like that movie a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I think we got some good choices. We've been on the air for almost 2.5 hours.
God, it's late.
That's good, but it had to be done.
No, it was good. It was really. I have to say, it was a show where every choice, every film mentioned, was a really good choice. Really, everyone that contributed tonight really did an awesome job.
I love that argument. It had to be done. Like it's a tetanus shot.
Yeah,
I know.
Really,
we're putting down a horse, broken its leg or whatever.
We had to remove the cyst.
Casey's shadow.
Great.
May I say something if I'm still on?
Yes.
I just want to say thank you guys so much for letting me call in. It really means a lot. I had so much fun.
No problem.
We had a lot of fun.
Happy to do it anytime.
Yeah, this is an awesome show tonight. This is definitely a lot of fun.
Conversation with Jerry and I that we had, it was like, I don't know, for some reason yesterday, we were just both on cue, and it just
walked.
Well,
you made me break out the Peter Biskin book on The Godfather.
Well, you had already brought up The Godfather.
Well, no, but
so
I brought up the book that I was explaining to you all the different, how the movie, the third one, could have been much worse than it was.
Were you ready to talk about that? Is that what you're saying? I thought, okay, I'm sorry. I messed up.
Okay, well.
I thought you already brought it up.
No, we did.
We had this huge Godfather thing, and it was all ready to go, and I dropped the ball, I guess.
No. We talked about it. That's the Godfather's a good conversation piece when it comes to sequels.
Yeah, definitely.
I think if anything comes from this 2.5-hour show tonight, I hope Hollywood finally gets around to making Ghost Rider 3.
The world is aching for it.
I know.
I'm on fire
for it.
I think that's the first thing I thought of walking out of the first one. I hope this is a goddamn trilogy.
I think Nicolas Cage, essentially Ghost Rider is like Nicolas Cage playing a big skeletal hemorrhoid. You know, it's like
who can hit fire.
I would welcome a sequel to Bad Lieutenant Port of Call New Orleans, though. I'd like to see him do that character again.
I would go to a buddy movie with Harvey Keitel and Nicolas Cage and a bad lieutenant.
Where is Harvey Keitel these days? He used to be all over the place, and now
he's in Moonrise Kingdom.
Nowhere.
Yeah, he's in Moonrise Kingdom.
Oh, he is. Okay. Oh, well, that's good. Okay. All right. I haven't gone to see that yet because I just don't know that I can take another Wes Anderson movie about substitute dads. I just can't do it.
Well, once you take that away from him, what else does he have?
Yeah. Maybe let's see a movie called 8. Which is like the sequel to 7. There's a new deadly sin in town. Could be the tagline. All right.
All right,
we'll be back Sunday night with master filmmaker William Friedkin, a special hour-long discussion with the director of The French Connection and The Exorcist, and a great classic filmmaker and one of our great conversations. So we look forward to bringing that to you on Sunday. And then in the weeks ahead, we have a Savages show with the composer and the author. We have a show with Martin Donovan, actor Martin Donovan.
Oh, what's Martin Donovan on for?
He just wrote and directed and stars in a movie called Collaborator with David Morse. I talked to him on Monday, and I'm going to ask the Pacino question since they were in Insomnia together.
That's right,
so.
Yeah. Another Nolan film, yeah.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good show.
No, thank you. It was awesome. Thank you, everyone.